And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity, and maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do bleh. Sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
And that marks that the Three Left Show is now live. The mics are now on.
Hello.
I'm Dan Platt, your intrepid host, with Jeremy Brock in the studio at Grand Street. And howdy ho, everybody. So, let's see. Lots to cover. I'm always torn between being a show that runs on the treadmill of covering current event stories, the things happening in the world, even locally, because the situation can change. Things are announced, meetings are held, and maybe something is happening. And there's so much to cover. And hopefully here on this station, we have more shows dedicated to that kind of reporting. But I'm also torn between talking about the bigger ideas, kind of a little touch and go on, you know, so to talk about ideas but not be a solely theory show, to talk about solutions but not just be a interview of the week where we talk to someone doing the work. There are shows that do that already, community radio stations. You can look up the podcasts that suit you. And I've encountered all of those types, but not one that does a little bit of everything in a structured way. Usually when a show is more of a hodgepodge, it's truly just a conversation and there's no structure, and it's just it can only be a podcast, not done on a radio, and I wonder if that could be done. So here I am, your host Dan Platt with Three Left Show. This is a show that covers radical politics from a left-wing perspective, social and anarchist, as the intro kind of maybe gave you the impression. So, and we're going to start with that kind of on that note, something lighter, and then we'll go into more local issues or state politics. So we're going to cover the governor's race. We'll play it by ear as well as we fill time, because because we're in the station, I'm just kind of waiting for the real go ahead to be that we're online. And so I've been focusing more on editing shows and the last 10 episodes we've recorded than preparing an outline and script.
10
for this
episodes.
One. This will be
that's
the,
awesome.
This will be the 10th, including wow. including 4 that I recorded before we started in the studio.
Okay.
So they're a little rougher.
That's a big that's a milestone, Dan.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Yeah, 10 episodes. Woo. Usually it's. Yeah.
Is it 100 episodes you cheer for?
It's usually 10 that the, you know, if this was on iTunes, we'd have 500 subscribers by now. But that's, since we're not online yet, that's not the case. So I'm just like, it's painful waiting with how long it's taking to get online. The stream first, and then how long will it take for us to be, have the new website? And then all the episodes will be put on SoundCloud,
and then
so
it's just
shareable.
A countdown until we get throttled, and
yes, we'll hit our height once we have to be popular first.
Yes, yeah.
And then once we do next week's show on Syria, then we'll be completely blacklisted,
demonetized.
Yeah, I mean, I think talking about Israel and Gaza last week would probably do it.
Definitely touchy, well. That's for sure. Touch and go.
Yeah, yeah. So. The first story is from Ceylon. I'm not a fan of Ceylon, for example. In the top bar here, one of the stories from their opinion is populism a threat to democracy? No.
Nope.
Okay. I'm going to say that emphatically. but they're also, something shared with me was, and they also, one of the sites that will say like, oh, I see you have ad blocker. You can't use this site until you turn off your ad blocker.
I just got told I can't access a site unless I fix my date and time.
Really?
That was a little strange.
That is, well, that's connected to the analytics.
Yeah. I could see the reasons why. But
there's the memes of Zuckerberg in front of Congress out of their complete depth, showing their incompetence. And it's like, you want, these are the people you want to lobby to regulate.
I love how they're
business.
Like, is it true that on the interweb you can steal my identity? Like, what?
I saw a meme where it's like, I got in the mail a floppy disk for 23 hours of AOL online. Does this allow me to X? Is this the same as Facebook? A lot of good memes there. So this is titled, Some Millennials Aren't Saving for Retirement Because They Don't Think Capitalism Will Exist By Then. Given poor economic prospects, many millennials, like ourselves, can't save anyway. But their hope for the future is social change. Quite a departure from previous generations. The usual status quo, because the underlying conditions of our lives have changed more than bureaucrats, technocrats, and the like will admit. And status quo warriors.
So it's not as bad as that we can't save. It's that we're being told that we just don't want to.
It's a little of both.
Okay.
As most binary questions, it's not always, because it's that would be a logical fallacy. But it's a little column A, a little column B.
Mm-hmm.
So CNN reported, so it starts with the CNN stat. 66% of millennials aged 21 to 32, that's me, have nothing saved for retirement. And while their writer chalks up this inequity to student loans, quote, stagnant wages and high unemployment, there may yet be a deeper cause. Many millennials honestly don't see a future in our economic system. Again, a little column A, a little column B. We don't see a future in our economic system because of stagnant wages, high unemployment, and the fact that we had to go into serious debt just to participate in the economy. That's a big barrier to entry.
Plus, I mean, I could add that.
So much for opportunities, right?
Why invest in something that's unstable when you can invest in something as stable as cryptocurrency or blockchain?
And there's nothing stable about the stock market. I mean, the point is that it has to go up. It's dropping now. In the last month, it has been in decline. So just like in 06, the next crash is coming. And this could be one underlying reason why a bunch of Republican congressmen are not running for re-election, including leader Paul Ryan. Now, there's the fact that they're not being able to get anything done. Them and Trump are at loggerheads, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also like, well, maybe they know something you don't. Now, they are incompetent as well, so maybe it is really just the political calculation that they know they're going to lose. So rather than lose in a humiliating way to real progressives that are challenging them now, thanks to the Bernie Crap movement, Our Revolution, similar groups, and Greens, it could be that, more cynically, the crash is coming and they don't want to be blamed. So let the Democrats retake the House so they get blamed.
It makes
sense.
Even
though Trump will be president, but his approval rating is already just 35%. And so it doesn't, anyone who supports him is going to support him. Anyone who thinks that he can be blamed for things will blame him for things.
I mean, as much as Trump is a Republican, wouldn't you say that?
He's an enigma.
That most Republicans already have, at first they denied his legitimacy.
Well,
of
he was
being
a Democrat
Republican
for most of his life, but that's just because he lived in New York where Democrats run everything.
Makes sense, yeah.
Unless it's Pataki or Giuliani. And then it becomes who's the top Italian, apparently.
Who's got the bigger hands?
So this is a fun little article because it has a lot of tweets and things. The aforementioned CNN article about millennials, or lack thereof, of retirement savings went semi-viral, partially because many saw humor in how it missed how many truly felt. Retweet, if socialism is your retirement plan, Hollywood 32, a political organizer, wrote. The idea that we millennials only hope for retirement is the end of capitalism, or the end of the world, is actually quite common sentiment among the millennial left. Jokes about being unable to retire or anticipating utter social change by retirement age were ricocheted around the internet long before CNN's article was published. So this tweet by Yes on Prop F. The year is 2055. The only retirement plan available is vlogging yourself, shrieking at kindergarten students about logical debate so that nihilist deaf cults will gift you enough Amazon credits that you can spring for that fancy bag of senior kibble.
Dude, this sounds amazing. Where do I sign up?
Frank Furtz School and a bunch of Hamilton sticker emoticons tweets, my investing style is I give $5 to Chapo in hope that their dumb butts will create socialism by the time I retire. Referring to a left-wing podcast. Swan Show tweets, my retirement plan is death. Very nihilistic. Lucretia Borgia, my retirement plan is death at 55, a millennial love story. Older generations and even millennials who are better off and who have managed to achieve a sort of petit bourgeois freedom might find this sentiment unimaginable, even abhorrent. And yet, in studying the reaction to the CNN piece and reaching out to millennials who have responded to it, I was astounded not only at how many young people shared Wood's feelings, but how frequently our expectations for the future aligned. Many millennials expressed to me their interest in creating self-sustaining communities as their only hope for survival in old age. I'm going to stop there because, you know, our economic system where we individually save for retirement, using the stock market, by the way, so that a whole generation of workers, or at least middle-class workers, their future retirement is tied to how well corporate America is doing. They have an interest in maintaining the status quo. You know, that's why the most you can get out of them is more. We need more diversity. And I talked to an artist friend of mine who went to, so there's this like Creative Worker Alliance, which is kind of a regional group for promoting and doing things involving the creative economy, which makes up 30% of our regional economy, the other big parts being healthcare and government. And they just did a panel discussion on diversity. And to him, it was another disappointment because they basically just invited the few black entrepreneurs that they knew that could be, you know, called creative, part of the creative economy. And just had them talk, but without much direction. Like, they didn't even know what they were going to talk about when they went there. The question was just, how do we make the arts more diverse? Which is, you know, kind of a masturbatory question.
Let's see your creativity by giving you no objective. And you then make the objective.
The objective is to make money, unfortunately. Okay. And so, like, that's always a bad incentive structure when it comes to being creative. Nothing makes you more creative than competing with others. And I'm being sarcastic here. So maybe I'll be deadpan and in earnest. Being competitive environments make people less creative. Nothing is more harmful. Back to the article. In general, and this is quoting a millennial, in general, I regard the future as a multitude of possibilities, but most of them don't look good, Elis Schwartzman, Schwartzman 29, a musician, told me. When I'm at retirement age, around 2050, I think it's possible we'll have seen a breakdown of modern society. Schwartzman said that he saw the future as encompassing one of two possibilities, an apocalyptic total breakdown of industrial society, or capitalism morphing into a complete plutocracy. Rule by the rich, a kind of neo-feudal system which is taking shape, actually, which is kind of why there's confidence that one of those two things will happen, because that's what the trend is. There needs, like, how do we stop that trend, reverse it, not a matter of reversing, but transform it into something else. All of this energy. Wood 32, a political consultant, told me via Twitter that she felt similarly. I don't think the world could sustain capitalism for another decade, she explained. It's socialism or bust. We will literally start having resource wars that will kill us all if we don't accept that the free market will absolutely destroy us within our lifetime if we don't start fighting its hegemony, meaning its dominance in our culture and so on. Capitalism might still exist in 2050, but I don't expect people will be happy about it, John Good, 34, a chocolatier and small business owner, said. If capitalism is replaced by then, my ideal economic model is one where all basic necessities are abundant and free. Everyone works a few hours a week at the necessary chores of society, like garbage and machine maintenance, then has the rest of their lives free to pursue whatever projects, be they art, luxury, or industry, that they desire. The name for this is a post-scarcity luxury economy. That utopian hope that we could theoretically end up in some sort of fully automated post-work social democracy, a la Star Trek, was expressed by others too. Quote, I think a system with universal basic income is inevitable if we're going to survive the automation of jobs as a society, Becca Cook, 30, told me. And also, the last minute, I'll point out that there is now this guy, a tech entrepreneur, I guess, his last name is Yang. He's running specifically to promote basic income. So I have a story on him. Maybe I'll mention it briefly again after the break, but we're about to hit it. You have a comment?
No, I just look forward to talking about universal basic income in our next break, I think.
And just to wrap this up, do you have anything in retirement savings?
I currently have I have a jar of quarters in right next to my bed. I've been saving up. I just add my loose change in every day. I jest, but yeah, I do have a 401k with my employer currently.
Right.
That's
management.
That's if I put my 40 years in, though, which I don't really plan on doing.
Mm-hmm. I have $270 that because I registered with the state retirement system.
Okay.
A little too late, actually. Only in the last year that I was working at my state job, but the assumption is that I'll work another state job eventually, which I don't really want to do, but it's possible. I've interviewed for enough positions and been turned down to not have much confidence. The show, we're all certified social justice warriors here. I actually haven't brought up the... Can you vamp for a moment?
Yeah, I can vamp. I recently watched Ready Player One. No spoilers.
No,
I'm not going to spoil
you
it.
Did?
I did. No,
oh,
no,
you
I
did.
Saw it.
Okay. Good.
I saw it in the theater, in the 3D portion of it, which, let me just rant here.
Go ahead.
Why are we forced to pay extra money for less quality viewing?
The 3D is lower quality.
I feel 3D is not, the technology isn't there yet, and we are just being forced to watch this lower animated animation. And I don't understand why I'm forced to pay more. Obviously, I'm not forced, but when there's only one option to see Ready Player One, and that's 3D, what am I supposed to not see Ready Player One? No, you got to go and see. It's all that pop culture.
The newest. You don't want to be behind on the pop culture.
Yeah, I can't miss that. So
the latest Spielberg. He's making fun movies again. He's done being serious. Now he's a fun grandpa.
Let me tell you something. This was a very fun movie. If I had to give you a review, I would give it six fingers. Okay, a six finger review. Out of 10, obviously. But no, it was very fun.
No toes included.
No toes included. No, I highly suggest everyone go out and watch it. But don't fork up the extra $12 for the 3D. It's
Wait, was it 12 on top of $10? It's
$12. $25 for a 3D ticket.
At 18? At Cross Gates?
Cross Gates, yeah.
Cross Gates. I haven't gone to Cross Gates in forever.
I was astonished.
Usually I go to Colony Center if I'm seeing a big AAA movie.
Yeah.
Or Spectrum if it's there.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I walked in thinking I was going to drop $20.
It was more.
Like, that was insane.
That proprietary technology doesn't pay for itself, for Jeremy.
This is true.
You
this
pay
is
interest
true.
I just wish
you could, like, tilt your head a little bit without the whole movie going distorted.
Blurry.
Yeah, unless you're sitting exactly at a 90-degree angle to the film.
Yeah.
It doesn't really...
Not like IMAX. That's where you can turn your head and everything's kind of...
I remember when I was a kid, you'd actually have these cool 3D glasses and things would come out at you, right? Like, do you remember that?
Well, that's very kitschy. And then when that movie is then put in other formats like TV and I'm watching it online or something like that, it then like, you know, oh, it's the 3D gimmick, but I'm not wearing glasses and it's just completely... You build the movie around those things.
Yeah.
Instead of the story and the characters, you do it around what they're doing. And that's always a bad recipe. That's bad art.
Yeah, so 3D is just, the technology just isn't there yet, unlike portrayed in Ready Player One. So here's to the future, 2055.
I'll listen to some other people like Chapo talk about it, but my hot take. I should probably not, since I haven't seen it, but like my impression watching the trailer and all that is, I'm sure it's a finely produced movie. I'm not talking about the actual quality of it. Just the themes that the future hinges on a reclusive billionaire and his fetch quest to gamers, that, you know, gamers have the power. And it's been pointed out by some other commentators I like. Gaming, video games is, it's embedded with capitalist culture, the competitive nature of it. You know, being cooperative is hard. You really have to work hard at being cooperative in a video game. Many video games, like the strategy games I play, are all about expanding, conquering. It's all very imperialistic as far as like what you're doing. You know, and it reinforces those mindsets if you only see the world and like, yeah, this is how things work. This is what history is like. This is what it is. Dog eat dog, and play Call of Duty. And it's just you get addicted. The feedback loops, the gameplay loops, they're called, of that reward, you know, the being competitive. I'm just going to put it broadly like that. I'm not going to put other qualifiers on it because I'm a gamer. I play first-person shooters. I play strategy games. So it's not like, you know, you play this and you're corrupted forever and you do that. But, I mean, it's just something to... But I'm conscious of it. I'm conscious of, like, what is the message here? What is the propaganda? Like, oh, when I play Call of Duty, there's the pro-military, you know, milieu of it. It's very strong.
Or did you somehow configure the story of the conspiracy theorists and the JFK shooting in the video game? And did you come up with some, I don't know where I'm going at with this, but no, there's
a lot
of stories,
man. It's all the Templars.
Well, there's a lot of stories in video games and they're definitely.
No, but I love Assassin's Creed.
Oh, it's great.
And
the way they use history and graphics and.
But there is all, it's fiction, you know, and that's very important, whatever the type of media, that you understand what's being embellished, you know, like that's very off topic, but like in talking about the historicity of Jesus Christ, you know, my take is it likely, you know, based on the true story kind of thing. You know, like there were many messiahs, people claiming, you know, to be spiritual leaders, and they were spiritual leaders because it was a time of upheaval. Roman oppression, the empire, you know, that's what the beast was. It was code by Jews, you know, because they were an underground social movement. And it's just that in that time frame, if you were going to have a social movement, it needed to also be a religious movement because the government claims godhood. Any monarchy or leadership in ancient times also claimed also to be demigods. So when you have your own social movement, you need your own demigod. At least that's my assumption based on the evidence, but there is no direct evidence that, you know, that Jesus Christ was a real person, but I'll assume there was a person who was giving great speeches and a spiritual leader worth paying attention to.
So if I'm following you right, realistically, in order to build a great political movement in this country, mm-hmm. we should emphasize Bernie as Jesus Christ.
I think some people have already done that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I've seen the T-shirts. But
when we're memeing people, we're making them into demigods, you know, American gods.
Yeah.
Capital and consumption is a god to people, where it's their entire being.
Well,
and
I mean,
take it away, they lose their crap.
We do that with the presidency, like...
Yeah, raising them up on a pedestal. They can do anything, and when they're not doing a good job or even just like maintaining the status quo. It's like people's hair, you know, their head, you know, they can't take it. Yeah.
No, I was just thinking about how we put the, not only put the presidency on the pedestal, but realistically, there's, in the last 50 years, we could say one president has died in office, right? But we take their health so seriously. We put them on this pedestal that they are above
When people are running.
Running.
Well, but that's a good segue then, because we got a young guy running for president.
Ooh.
So the title, this is
he mature enough?
This is CNBC, mainstream news, so he's getting coverage for what it's worth. 2020 presidential candidate wants to give everyone $1,000 a month. Now, I just want to point out that as a basic income, $1,000 is not going to do it.
Nothing, yeah.
Now, the left-wing position, so there's right-wing libertarian positions on basic income, people who promote it. The left-wing position, to be more precise, it's not everybody, but it's like, okay, you have a basic income that is, let's say, $10,000 a year. And then, or you know, I guess $1,000 a month, $12,000 is actually not bad. That's actually what I make in a year. And, but you also need to provide all those other basics like housing and healthcare and education. Those things need to still be free, or rather public goods. And the basic income is then put on top of that so that people can actually consume, and it would, and then you can use that to replace food stamps and other those things, but it should not replace all other public programs. It should be complementing them, and then you simplify the public programs and make them more universal, because that's what makes it cheaper, and you don't have to worry about means testing and the injustices of that, the implicit bias and the institutional racism, and so on and so on. So this is entrepreneur Andrew Yang has a big goal for relatively unknown business person. I don't care if he's unknown. He's a citizen in the U.S., and that's what matters. To reach the White House. And he's aiming to get there by selling America on the idea that all citizens aged 18-64 should get a check for $1,000 a month, no strings attached, from the U.S. government. Oh, Yang is 43, so... who was born in upstate New York in 75, so he's, I guess, local. I don't know where he lives now. And says he'll be running as a Democrat, according to his campaign website. People who think the antidote to Donald Trump is a boring, generic Democrat miss the point. He is a sign of massive institutional failure on both sides. But then why run as a Dem? That's my question.
So Yang was born in Schenectady, New York.
Ah.
Yeah, in like 1975. Ray.
The most direct and concrete way for the government to improve your life is to send you a check for $1,000 a month and let you spend it in whatever manner you benefit the most. Before you, and they say, whenever this is tested, the results are always positive in the best way possible. Whether it's giving homeless people cash, you know, they spend it on the things they need to actually get a job. If you just give them the basics, they're still not getting the means to go to an interview. You know, you need a bus card, you need a cell phone, you need a suit.
I was talking to my grandma yesterday. She's another local to upstate New York, but she doesn't currently live in upstate New York. But anyway, I had asked her, because we were talking about politics as old people do, and I'd asked her like about the trickle down economy, and if she was given an extra $100 because she fits into this tax bracket where she got a tax cut or whatnot, but if she was given that extra $100, what would she spend it on? And her answer was pretty simple: nothing, because
she doesn't need it.
She doesn't need any extra money.
Right.
She doesn't need an extra tax break because she already has. It's not going to inflict any extra cost to her, so therefore, these tax breaks and this trickle-down economy hasn't helped in the last 30 years.
Oh, of course not.
So let's try something new. Like
there's a number,
UBI.
There's a number of configurations for UBI to be implemented. So there's the argument for going full universal. Everyone, billionaire to the lowest, gets the $1,000 a month. There's the negative income tax, where if you make over a certain bracket, you don't need this money, you don't get it. But, I mean, it's basically deducted from your taxes. So I guess you aren't getting it. But as far as... But if you then make under a tax bracket that you wouldn't be paying taxes, you get that $1,000 a month as a negative income tax. You get money back regardless. It's not a matter of, let's say, when I get a check back from the government at tax time for deductions and whatever, a tax rebate as it were, I'm just getting back what I already paid the government, but I'm not getting anything extra. So like the less interest I pay on my student loans, the less I get back. Even though I'm paying the same college loan payment. So, you know, and he gives the standard kind of techie reasons for supporting basic income. I've worked with, it is impossible to overstate the positive impact of $1,000 a month on households around the country. It would take people from a constant mindset of scarcity to a mindset of assured survival and possibility. It would transform our society in myriad positive ways by taking the boot off of people's throats. So it's important that he is framing it as far as like this is, you know, to help oppress people, the people who our economy has deemed to be unnecessary. As all of us are expendable. We're all expendable. Without contracts, you know, we can be fired and no moral argument need be made. Good news, by the way, the nurses at Albany Med have just voted to unionize. They succeeded.
It's about time.
Which is, years ago, I sign waved as they were handing out pamphlets and starting to outreach. And I was wondering, you know, I think after they had tried before, but their vote failed. But this is a good lesson in, you know, perseverance, taking your time. It's taken a good several years, the last 4 years, but they've done it. Just like other nurses union, nurses have at various hospitals in the area. And with healthcare being the 40% of the regional economy that it is, it is very important to kind of bump up unionized numbers. And with that, these unions can work together. They can fund progressive candidates, even though these unions, new or otherwise, are being pressured and arm twisted in supporting the status quo, which is something they should resist wholeheartedly, which just as they've resisted their management, the Democratic Party is just the management of government, the bosses. They got to be taken down a peg. Why $1,000 a month? Yang settled on the level of $1,000 a week. He tells CNBC, make it. First, $1,000 a month was recommended by former Service Employees International Union, that's CEIU, that is union that's big around here.
Dan, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What happens if you receive this $1,000 a month and you don't need it?
You don't need it.
Yeah, like let's
I guess
just
you
say
save it.
You save it,
and accumulate
spend
it,
give it to someone, give it to a charity.
The point is that the currency is not being hoarded by billionaires who aren't going to spend it at all, because rich people actually spend less per capita or whatever.
I like what you just said. That's brilliant. Yeah.
It's the rich do not overspend. It is the poor that spend more because
they need to on need higher to. Interest rates
and,
on
and whether it's
late
housing
fees,
or whatever. Yeah. I mean, we pointed it out before. After you have 80,000 max, you're not spending money much anymore. Only on various luxuries that are just have a high market value but no use value.
Let me
more cars, you know.
I think it's hysterical. I did my taxes this last week and I used TurboTax to do it. I don't know if you've ever used TurboTax. It's basically
I did once, but I've been using The Fed has a few free ones.
It's basically
I've used the free one this time, and that was actually a good thing. I was using Tax Slayer for a few years, but they I think either got more expensive,
mm-hmm.
or they're always charged for the state return.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe the federal one was free, but it didn't seem to be this time. Maybe I input something wrong, but then I switched and it worked out. Jeremy's on the phone right now, but otherwise, I want to transition then, talking about a presidential candidate running as a Dem, it kind of reminds me of Lawrence Lessig. He was a reformer of sorts, written a lot of book, Harvard professor or other Ivy League school. And I'm a good fan of him. I liked his work. I read Remix, which is his book on copyright reform. And that book, he kind of has a drumbeat about how money in politics prevents any meaningful reform from happening, right? Our system is completely owned and controlled by capital. Not capitalists. It's not people. It's the force of capital itself. That money needs to produce more money. No matter what is commodified, whether it be the very air and water, the water we drink, the air we breathe. Welcome back, Jeremy. I was just talking about Lawrence Lessig, who was also running. He ran as a Democrat as an issue campaign. So whether or not they got any votes, which they didn't, they still toured and talked to people and promoted their issue. Lawrence Lessig's being money out of politics, amend the Constitution, that kind of stuff. He started a PAC, which I actually contributed to, but it was another failure because they ended up just endorsing and giving the money to status quo politicians who just said they would push for reform. But few of them won, even though they were going after safe districts. So they didn't take any chances, and they didn't actually use this massive war chest they built up to fund in competitive, not just the competitive races, but to switch districts. But it was more about like established congressmen and getting them to endorse this idea. So I didn't, his strategy was terrible. But before that, ran for president, or maybe that's what he's doing now, or in the last election. And it seems Yang is doing the same thing. So we'll see how that goes. But like my criticism, or suggestion rather, for Yang is make sure you're organizing people along the way, seeding these pro-UBI groups, not just massing a bit of support and seeing like this is, and using that metric, like the number of votes you get, the number of people that come to your events, using that as a metric, that's very superficial. Make sure that they're like signing up to organize them, to recruit people into an organization that can push for UBI and actually create a coalition, and all these other groups can sign on. And that's what a social movement really is, right? Not just a hashtag campaign and a big march, which is like, whether it's be the Women's March, Science March, that's coming up. You know, what are the real policies? What's the real platform? And what's, and besides the platform, like what's the action items? What can people do besides call their representative that is bought by capital? But who is doing this? Well, actual left-wing parties, whether it be Socialist Alternative or the Greens, which I belong to, which is kind of my introduction to, you know, why am I a Green? Besides all the other politics that I have, or ideas and agendas, the Greens are simply, to me, a tool for taking state power, whether it's totally possible or not. Just to have that option and the possibility of it, the ability to do so. And that requires a ballot line and an organization to maintain that line so that there's access to the ballot box to run these campaigns. Otherwise, the massive barriers that have been put in place by the two major parties, whether it be petitioning, the ability that you need to fundraise massive amounts to advertise, to even so people even know. There's no default amount of media that you should get. You have to actually depend on the laurels of ethical journalists to give you equal coverage, or even just a little bit of coverage when you announce. So Howie Hawkins of the Green Party, running for the third time's charm, is running again. So he just announced Thursday, and I was there for it, with a little press conference. I think three actual organizations were there. News organizations. I don't have the full clip of him talking up, but first, just talking about the Green Party generally. So when there's a lot of Tina arguments, like there's no alternatives to running as a Democrat, you know, why doesn't, you know, Yang, he's talking being independent and that the both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, these status quo parties, have failed and they're not promoting real issues. So why is he running as a Dem? Why not just have an independent campaign, whether or not you can file all the petitions that he needs? At least he's going around promoting, you know, you don't need to be running for president to promote UBI and to start an organization to promote it. But as far as implementing it, you do need to win some elections and get people allied with that in office. And for that, that requires actual political organizations. And that's what parties are. Whether or not a party is pursuing electoral politics or not, they don't have to. But at least the Green Party exists so that you can use electoral politics. And that's why I'm a Green. So some...
I was going to say, I mean, as far as Andrew Yang's campaign goes, he has actually a really great video on fixing the flow of human capital, a TED talk back in 2012.
And I don't like referring to humans as capital, but yeah.
But if you want to see a sense of his platform, mm-hmm. I'd highly suggest. I mean, it's very rare you get to see a presidential nominee. Or not nominee, but runner.
Candidate.
Talk for 15 minutes uninterrupted. And you kind of get to see, you know, you kind of get to see where he...
I thought they do all the time, but it's just a matter of who's listening.
That's true.
TED Talks are great. I'm not as big a fan as I used to be, mm-hmm. but certainly in my formative years in college, I watched all of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of...
But then it got big, and then it was ruined.
It kind of sold out a little bit, and they had TED Talks.
It was always sold out because it's a convention of millionaires for millionaires.
Okay.
And their decision was just that we're going to share all of these talks intended for us with everyone else.
Oh, wow.
So, like, the millionaires investors are the audience.
Well, I'm just wondering, where's Hillary Clinton's TED Talk, you know? I want to see the bankers.
She hasn't... Can you name something she's innovated on?
Well, I just like to see... I would have enjoyed seeing what she said to those bankers back in the day. Or any of her big corporate...
We have plenty of quotes. Talks. We have what she's saying now.
Okay.
And Obama, too. Sorry.
No, that's cool. I would love to see...
Obama's giving $500,000 talks.
I would
bankers.
Love to see what a $500,000 would buy. That's all. That's all I would like to see. Like, what can I get him to say for $500,000?
Oh. Well, if you could pay him,
yes,
maybe we could even have him say left-wing things, actual. Maybe pretend it's 08 again and be and pretend he's a progressive and not a Republican.
I like
so,
that.
I'm going to go over what I see, and this is not the be-all, this is not a definitive list, of objections to either organizing with the Green Party, voting for Green candidates. It depends on who is being asked, and this is my experience as I've outreached, as I've talked to people at festivals or what have you. So if it's liberals, self-described liberals or moderates, their usual lack of support is based on bad faith arguments. Spoiler arguments. Greens spoil elections for Democrats. We take votes away that apparently they deserve to have. It's also a mindset of scarcity of voters, that there's a defined amount of voters. You can't expand the voter base, that all the people who aren't voting would never vote if you actually offered something different or actually outreach to them. Because the treadmill in local or, you know, national politics is to go out and seek the votes of people who are the prime voters. They're called the prime voters in campaigns. People who vote consistently, every year or every other year. And who are these? Demographically, they're usually older. People who have time, who can go out on a Tuesday, aren't working two jobs, so on. And if they do vote, then it's hard, and there's barriers to that. So where to go next? Another bad faith argument is just kind of the usual when the mainstream media talks to Greens or talks about Greens, it's always framed negatively. There's never, it's always in this bad faith way, whether it's even comedians like John Oliver misrepresenting our platform and our policy, and then as a straw man and making arguments against that. Like, oh, no, this is Jill Stein wants to create money. We can't do that. That's not, that's magical thinking. Except that's what the government does all the time. It's just doing it for social purposes instead of war.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the platform of the Greens, of Jill Stein. And the smearing of her, not, Russiagate's just the newest incarnation, but of course there's like, she's a doctor whose literal bona fides are in environmental justice activism. And then, and you basically, you take the strength and you make it a weakness by saying she is critical of Wi-Fi around children, even though in European countries there are limits because the studies, the science says that it is affecting, that it does create these health problems. And so are you rational and science-based and evidence-based, or are you in fact just a team player for the Democrats and you're going to attack the Greens no matter what? So that's what I would call bad faith. That you just, it doesn't matter what the Greens do. We could do everything that you say we're not doing, or I could even show you how we are doing everything that you
say
we're
not doing.
Let me just
ask this. This is a rumor that I've recently heard. Mm-hmm. Is it true that the Green Party wants to put a tax on the color green?
No.
No. Okay. No. I'm just making sure.
We want to tax capital.
Okay.
We want to tax capital. Nothing else, really. We
and
actually want.
You don't want to make every color green. That's another thing I've heard. No?
No.
Okay. I'm just.
That's what I would call a straw man. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Good.
Or that we're unserious. You know, yes, yeah, sometimes there are some candidates that we do unserious things. But these are like, to me, this is like the old guard. These are the people that are, sometimes they're Democrats that wanted to be a political boss or some operator. And they weren't able to do it. So they joined a different party that had a ballot line or something like it. And became a political operator there. So they're always bad faith actors as far as like believing in the platform or like they're just Democrats with a green coating. And they usually embarrass the cause, as it were. In spoilers, like in actual evidence, there is no spoiler effect. There's very few instances where a third candidate in a race cost the election for one of other two, statistically speaking. I'll have to dig up that article that lists the data. It's a little complicated, though. I mean, it's just I'm going to simplify it and say there's no such thing as spoiler effect. It's entirely in your mind. Self-described progressives, and I'm talking about people who run as Democrats even though their politics aren't mainstream or in the Democratic Party.
Well, because I would think you
Bernie-crats, let's say.
I was going to say, you kind of have to at some point. If you want to, I always see it as, if you want to change the two-party system, mm-hmm. unfortunately, you have to run as one of those two parties to change the system. I mean, I just see that as being the easier way of beating the system than...
And that's one of those, that's one of the main arguments, and that's kind of, yeah, exactly. That is the argument these self-described progressives mm-hmm. make. You can't build a new party. You have to work within the system. Now, as a diversity of tactics, I am amenable, or rather, I'm empathetic to the ideas around that you need to have people on the inside and outside fighting together. But they need to be on the same page and coordinate. And that doesn't happen. And in Albany, there isn't enough people on the outside. What if everyone's working on the inside? Then you are the system. When is, you know, do you draw a line for yourself of when you're helping the system? You know, like, I was even having a more radical revolutionary discussion with a friend about, like, you know, using a skill set to make a lot of money by helping businesses by facilitating their meetings, right? They always have terrible meetings. As a facilitator with a radical background, I could bring some horizontality into their meeting structure and actually really help them be more efficient. But do I want them to be more efficient? And then he says, like, well, you could do it. You give them bad advice. Like, I don't think I'm going to last long in that field then. But I could do some damage. But, you know, that's lying, and I don't want to lie and trickery. And there's enough Scammers. I'll just use the word scammers. There's enough scammers out there.
That's a real word.
So to move on, but can't build a new party. What's my response to that? That you do need an outside force. And that's the argument that Greens make most emphatically. So then there's...
Well, I mean, we've tried to make the third party, and it's so hard. Like, let's just take the city of Albany, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to organize...
The people who aren't voting?
The people who aren't voting.
No one ever tries.
Take me, for instance. I'm 26 years old, I think. Mm-hmm. Birthday's coming up. I'm not sure. After a while, you just forget. But anyway, so in the last 3 years, I've lived in Albany. I've moved twice. My polling stations are in different places every time I go. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to vote the last 2 years.
And those are the barriers that are... systemic, and that's like, and what do those barriers do? They only shore up the argument that you have to run as a Dem.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, but it's kind of like, well, let's put it in a fictional context. Well, you know, the dark overlord. You know, he is mass murderer who killed my parents, but he does have a really big army, and his army is making sure that I can't go where I want to quest. So I might as well join his army. And get the dark mark and whatever, and that's what it's like to me, to accept. It's almost like accepting defeat.
It does. I mean, it's just
won. They've it's their game and you're gonna play it.
Yeah.
And thus, but they're gonna win. It's the casino. It's their house, their rules, and even if you win on a progressive platform, then you're caucusing with them. You'll have their organization bearing down on you. And if you actually try to vote, let's say against their priorities, let's say those priorities are tax cuts for the rich, private corporate welfare, so on. You vote against that, they're going to punish you and you're going to lose the next time. They're going to run against you. And you're not going to even be independent because it's going to be in their primary. So they can do all kinds of things to sabotage you. Happens in Albany all the time. It's what happened to Jeb Crasher. It's what happens to anyone who doesn't vote in lockstep with the mayor, whoever the mayor is.
And that's just how the political system works, right?
Like, that's the status quo.
That's the...
So in my mind, look, if you're against the status quo, you got to be outside of it.
Yeah.
So that's my response to progressives. Live here on this beautiful Saturday, it's finally... Oh, wait, no, it's still freezing. It's still really cold and windy. When is it? I'm going to point out, we had a really late winter.
Mm-hmm.
It was still warm in November.
I think it was.
It was in the 50s in November.
Spaghetti
60s.
Strap.
And so it's just balance, I suppose. You know, the world, the universe wants to be in balance. And our contributions to the ecos and the atmosphere isn't helping with that.
It gets so hot and then it has to get so cold and mm-hmm. has to
don't expect all the produce that you expect.
Someone told me the other day kinds. It's the cold weather's good because it kills all the germs outside, and I never really thought about like killing all like no but, like all the bugs, all the germs, all the
okay, but then we have no life cycle, and I mean, we have we could have the ecosystem of a tundra,
mm-hmm.
And if that's where we're going, but no, it's more that we're going to have colder winters and hotter summers, and the summers will be long and the winters will be long, either alternatively year to year, or there's just no middle. It's either going to be cold or it's going to be hot. So how you adapt to that is to have infrastructure that stores cold or hot to release it when you need it.
I got an idea. Why don't we...
Which is what people used to do in the past before fossil fuels, really.
Why don't we just build, like, a wall, right? A wall across the western seaboard.
To keep the jet stream out?
To keep the jet stream out. And we'll just keep all the warm air in. And
well, let's see. If we're going to take that to its logical conclusion, it would be we need to straighten the jet stream out.
Okay.
So we need like barriers where it's bending
mm.
and then becoming off kilter, and try to get it in line with the latitudes again.
Okay. I mean,
all impossible.
Yeah, possible.
But yeah, that's the logic of we're going to create more man-made bowl.
Well, I mean, we got to keep the winner out, man. It's like keep the winner's coming.
Along, yeah, the north is the north all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Got to keep Canada out.
Well, it's also the hot air that's also disrupting things. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's all about balance. Hot air moves to cold air.
Back to the Green Party and addressing and actually addressing climate catastrophe.
Good tag in there with the balance.
So social Democrats that. Like then there's the group, a third group. So I covered, people who are in the Democratic Party and strongly Democrat, people who are progressives and are in the Democratic Party, but they really don't want to be, but they feel like they have to be the left wing of a war party. But it's other shows like Jimmy Dore will talk at length about why that's a bad strategy, mm-hmm. right? It's been the strategy of these groups for decades, and it's just, where are the results? I need to know. And they probably say, well, where are the results for the Green Party? Well, Howie makes a case for that we're stronger in opposition, we're stronger when we're independent. So imagine how much more we could do if we actually had the support of people who are on the fence about this. So, and then there's a group. I'm going to call them social democrats, democratic socialists, who, not to touch defining that, but they know we need a new party, but not the Green Party. And they're major, and you ask them over and over, why do we need a new Labor Party? The Green Party is established. We've been organizing for 20 years. It's been off and on. We've had our bumps and bad strategies ourselves. But that's the point. We've been experimenting and we've been working, and now we have almost a majority of ballot lines across the country, right? When we run a presidential candidate, we're in most states, only a handful that we're not. And that's taken 20 to 30 years to build. Now you want to start from scratch? It's got to be 10 years before you can run a presidential candidate of note.
Let's have three more parties. That sounds good. Like, I want a purple, orange, and a yellow.
A Spirita, you know, like Greece and Spain, Podemos in Spain. And that's when you need a parliamentary system. So we need massive election reforms, as you pointed out. We need election reforms to our system, whether it be making it more liquid or just accessible. And one of the things we're fighting for, the criminal... the prison justice, they want to extend the franchise to prisoners. Massive amount of people that are imprisoned, and you're basically taking people off the board because the status quo likes keeping the voter base small. They don't want to organize. They don't want more voters. They like it small.
I thought it was crazy.
Less work.
When I saw the last U.S. election where it was something like a third of the U.S. population had voted.
Yeah,
I think it was like less than 100, or maybe just over 100 million, something along those lines.
Yeah,
that's pretty.
That's not a win for anybody.
Yeah, that sounds.
That's not saying, oh, the people have spoken.
Sounds like a third of the country's voting.
It's not popular. Yeah, it's and that's for both candidates. And as Jill pointed out again, it was one of her tropes was that these are both terrible candidates, that were both disasters in different ways, and people in droves are saying we want neither. They were always saying it before the election, and of course they were saying it by not voting. And it was just a matter, but at the same time, as Jill was trying to promote, it's like, hey, there's a third, there's more choices here. The media would then project her as being this incompetent, unserious candidate who isn't worth voting for.
Look at her; she can't even choose the same type of shoes to wear every day. Why is
she can't decide whether she wants her hair long or short?
Yeah. How is she going to pick a political party if she can't even decide that? Yeah.
But her and all of our candidates are usually our strongest candidates are the ones that like help found the party or have been part of it for years. But now we have a new crop of organizers that have just joined in the last few years. Tony Nidge is one. He's helping organize in North Carolina. He's a great, fantastic guy. He's going to be, I think, I don't know if he made it on the steering committee of the national now. But I'm also going to point out, like, Green Party mistakes, which also play into some of the things that critics of the Green Party point out, particularly the spoiler effect. So in 04, you probably didn't notice the Green Party even had a campaign in 04. I certainly didn't. And this was because they adopted the strategy of the safe, we call it the safe state strategy. Okay, we're going to address the criticism of progressives that were a spoiler, right? Especially after 2000. We're going to only run our campaign and focus on safe blue states that Kerry is going to win. This was a disaster. And so even when you could address every criticism that's thrown at the Green Party, it won't matter. The arguments are made in bad faith because more progressives didn't turn out for David Cobb, our candidate. Ralph Nader was like, the condition was that he actually joined the party when he hadn't yet.
And yeah, I always thought,
His principle is, I will always be no party.
Okay.
And it's like, can you at least be a Green and be a member? And no, he refused.
Is it the same concept with Ron Paul back in like 2000? No?
He's always been a Republican.
I thought he was pushing for a third party.
Ron Paul's never voted. He's never ran as a Libertarian, if that's what you mean.
Okay. No,
Same with Rand. I mean,
yeah.
They're in Senate because they ran as Republicans. And so Libertarians, for all of their juicy anti-status quo rhetoric, also don't gain much steam. They don't even have a ballot line.
Yep.
Because they're individualistic thinkers. They can't organize. So,
well, I would think that's the same concept as we were talking about before, of infiltrating the third or the two-party system to exploit your Green Party ideas.
But you end up getting half measures every time.
Oh, no.
And you end up basically not winning.
Yeah,
and
there's no...
So the safety strategy was a complete disaster. Ever since then, we've been running, and we lost more ballot lines. Because when it comes down to it, some states, you can only get the ballot line by having a presidential count in the first place. And so diverting resources from... We lost ballot lines. So we lost a lot of momentum in the Bush years because we were listening to progressive criticism, apparently, that they won't join or help unless we're being friendly to the Democrats and not being an opposition party. But as soon as we start actually being oppositional, okay, so getting in 08, okay, now we start getting a little momentum back. I mean, we're starting from almost zero. It's a big mess. It still technically is. But now there's all these other locals now, especially New York. Got Glens Falls area Greens, Warren County. There's new chapters starting in the South in the Hudson Valley area. And I'm going to work to make sure that the area Greens are more... We have more active members, that's for sure. And some are actually younger, too. Not old. Yeah, and I haven't even gotten how yet. But this is all just kind of... This is a necessary conversation to me because it's been on my mind. We don't go over all the issues at once of, like, why do people put down the Green Party? And why is it that when I was running for mayor and petitioning Greens and talking to all the registered Greens, most of them were all white men. And this hurt. How to get more people registered. It's just you door knock, you talk to them, you say Green Party actually stands for workers. Most people don't even know we exist. Some people register green because they like the color, as you pointed out. Don't know anything
it's a
about
solid
it.
Solid color.
Mm-hmm.
It's very lots of different shades.
Yeah. So even those that believe that we need a new party, a labor party or something like that, they're not fully behind the Green Party. And the main thing they say is the brand is damaged. This is also bad faith because it's only based on their own anecdotal evidence. Well, regardless of what the brand is, the status quo will attack it and slander it. So it's saying like, well, the Greens were slandered, but our Labor Party won't be. I think that's complete bull. I mean, I don't know why they believe it. It seems like a misstep in reasoning. Why don't you think the status quo will slander whatever you're doing? You're going to have an uphill battle no matter what. Why not do it with people who have been in this and doing this for decades? That was the reason I joined. I joined as soon as I learned that the Green Party is actually left wing, because of the mainstream, or because of the Bush years, where whenever Green was there was still rhetoric about helping the middle class and not being anti-capitalist. But as soon as I learned the Green Party had a lot of socialists in it, and it was just the PR was bad PR. And like, oh, so to me, it was all about like, okay, the Greens need to say we are socialists, we're proud. And how he's doing that, mentioning eco-socialism and what that means, and that it isn't just using government as, you know, in New Deal stuff, which, you know, Bernie-crats do, and they're running as Dems for that. So be farther left and actually speak to the issues. And it's my usual quip back is the brand is damaged to you. That doesn't mean it's damaged for everyone else, because everyone else, speaking broadly, are ignorant that the party even exists. And maybe they have their only interaction with the Green Party is Jill being on CNN or a short video where she doesn't get a word in edgewise. I talked to one guy, really, really great guy, by the way. So nothing about him whatsoever. Keep him anonymous. And he's a friendly guy. I like him a lot. And I mentioned Green Party came up or something, and what his opinion of Jill was. And he had a negative opinion because he thought that she was dodging questions by basically outlining what her platform was. Because guess what? On mainstream media, they don't ask you for your platform. They don't ask you what your ideas are. They're asking you about the posturing and the strategy, the political calculus. That's all on Fox News and MSNBC, that's all they're talking about. And it's rare. I mean, they can, but what are the actual issues? What are the actual politics? What is it people actually support? Because, as progressives would point out, our platform is widely popular. When asked about single payer, even majority of Republicans support it. Why hasn't it passed yet? Status quo power. And that's just one example.
I mean, I would say the number one argument, and it's so hard to keep beating this over the head, is it hasn't passed because corporations don't want it to pass, because the money's not there to make it pass. Where are the profits if single payer does pass?
Well, we're one state senator away, though, from really? Passing it in New York.
That's amazing.
And it's just the governor has to step up.
Okay.
So it's really just him.
Who? What governor?
Governor Cuomo.
Cuomo.
But we can change that. He's up for election this year.
Yes, he is.
Which is why I'm talking about this in the first place. But generally, we're going to also have the Greens have two congressional candidates. I'll talk about more as the time goes on, my own feelings about them. But I'm going to be generally positive, obviously. These are independent candidates.
It is early.
They're independent candidates. So organizations like the DSA, even when their chapters are electorally minded and want to endorse candidates, and we're like, look, we have the line. Run your socialist candidate on our line. That's why it's here. It's here for you. We'll endorse you. We don't even, like, registering as green is the only preconditioning. And you can be registered green and be a DSA member and an out-and-out socialist. It's those things are, like, totally compatible. And there'll be a lot of no's. Like, no, your brand's damaged. We need our own socialist line. And we need to work hard to petition to get our own socialist line. It's what the DSA did in New York City with Jamal. I forget his full name. But they had the green line. He was running as a green. And he wanted DSA's endorsement. They gave it. They were helping in a big way. But they would only help if they created their own ballot line to say they have a socialist candidate, because in their eyes, the green line is damaged, even though their line got fewer votes, you know, for Jamal than the green line did. You know, there's no data supporting the people. The only data is a circular argument that people don't vote green because we can never win. That's what it comes down to me. It's always a circular argument. I put it on my page, this little meme. from Idiocracy, Circular Reasoning 101. It's like, oh, I can't vote green. We can't let the Republicans win. But if we all vote green, they'll win. No, man, they can't win. Why not? Because no one votes for them.
So by not wanting to throw your vote away, you're throwing your vote away.
Yes.
And it's...
When... It's like, well, you ask them, like, why is the brand damaged? Oh, because they're unserious. What makes you think they're unserious? Because they never win. Why don't they ever win? Because their brand is damaged. It's always circular
logic. Why is their brain damaged?
The brand?
Why?
Because there's... corporate media slanders them.
Why does corporate media slander?
Not just slander. Yeah, why do they slander them? Because they don't want alternatives.
Why don't they want alternatives, Dan?
Because they're just status quo and they're in power and they like that. They
bring
like
it back
stuff.
Full circle.
They like stuff.
Why do they like stuff, Dan?
They like shiny things. They like stuff. Okay, we're into our next break. Do you like shiny things? Stay tuned to the Relive Show.
And if you don't, vote green.
And I'm just going to go right into playing video from, or audio, of how his announcement Thursday at the Legislative Office Building.
Work. And I'm also glad she introduced me, because when people think of green, it's sort of the first thing they think of are the environmentalists. But we have an understanding that the attempt to dominate nature is connected to the domination of human by human. So that when we dominate, exploit each other, those same attitudes are extended toward our regard for nature. And so in order to reharmonize society with nature, we gotta reharmonize human with human and do away with these injustices from racism, sexism, and class exploitation and all the other ways people are dominated by structural injustice. And I'd also note, she mentioned Khalif Browder, who was locked up because he couldn't make bail for a few years, and he had a bad time in prison, got a lot of beatings, and when he came out, he couldn't handle it, he ended up committing suicide. His brother ran for mayor as the Green candidate last year in New York City, and I've been seeing him on TV. He's down here lobbying for that bail reform, which we strongly support. So I'm gonna try to compress what are a lot of issues the state faces into about 10 or 12 minutes. And we sort of come to the theme that our theme's gonna be, our slogan's gonna be, demand more. We're saying to the people of New York, and particularly the progressives, you gotta have higher expectations from our government. We got politicians going to prison more than any other state, over 40 since 2000, both parties. We have higher expectations of what government can and should do. We want more reforms. We believe that 5% that we got in 2014 make Cuomo compete for progressive votes and make some moves our way to try to get those votes back, like the ban on fracking, which we campaigned for, the $15 minimum wage, paid family leave, the millionaire's tax. And I've got a list now of 19 different issues where he's at least talked our way if he hadn't completed the action that's needed. And then we want to demand more than piecemeal reforms. We got to demand system change, because we're facing life and death issues, climate catastrophe, and let's face it, poverty kills. People of color have had lower life expectations because they're on the lower part of an unjust economic system. And now the system's really hammering the whole working class. And we know life expectancies for white working people have been going down the last decade. That's a crisis that's totally unnecessary in a society as rich as ours. So we have crises, and it's going to take system change to find real solutions to these problems. So that's what demand more means: higher expectations, more reforms, and system change. Raising expectations starts with cleaning up Albany. And we've got down here a quid pro quo, pay-to-play culture of corruption. And even when they don't find proof of legal bribery, these campaign contributions from the rich in the corporations expecting favors is legalized bribery, which Grandpa Al Lewis used to talk about when Alice Green was his lieutenant governor running mate back in 1998. And nothing's changed since then. Just a lot more politicians have gone to prison, and we probably only know the tip of the iceberg. And like I said, what isn't brought before the courts is still legalized bribery, and the rich folks have undue influence. So if we're gonna eliminate the quid pro quo, eliminating the quid means something for something, quid pro quo. What's the first something? The campaign contributions. We're saying we need a clean money system,
full public campaign financing. If you opt in, you get a grant sufficient to communicate your message to the voters, and you take no private money. And because of Buckley v. Baleo, some people will take private money, they'll get it from the rich, but at least it'll be clear who they are and where their money's coming from. And we're not settling for this partial matching fund system, which the Democrats, who used to have a clean money bill, have switched to. And all that does is put some matching funds on top of the same old pile of crap, the private money. It makes it look good, and it's still a steaming pile of crap. And that's a reform that doesn't reform, and we're not going to stand here and say we're going to settle for that. We're not. And then eliminating the pro quo means eliminating the corporate welfare that Cuomo's turned into a statewide patronage system and has fed this corrupt culture of pay-to-play. And what he does is supply-side trickle-down economics. It's the conservative economics that's been the dominant bipartisan policy for the last 40 years. And look at upstate New York. We're still struggling. We get a Buffalo billion, and we get to build a factory in Syracuse for a company that decides not to come. And it's really about creating favors instead of a level playing field for all businesses and really improving the business climate. Our alternative is demand side instead of supply side. Bottom up instead of trickle down. Improve the conditions for working people. And we got to improve our own conditions. I hope these nurses vote for the union at Albany Medical Center. I know they're voting right now. We want the direct benefits, not indirect through the rich. It's supposed to trickle down, it never does. And when we do that and increase the benefits directly to the working people, it increases demand, that stimulates the economy, and they have to expand business and hire people and create jobs to meet that demand. And so when we talk about the Green New Deal, a lot of times it sort of gets shortened down to the clean energy thing. We're gonna build clean energy and create a lot of jobs, and that's certainly a central piece of it. But we're talking about revitalizing the whole public sector. We need broadband that everybody has access to and can afford. We need, what, $100 billion for mass transit to fix up the system down at the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority in New York City, plus billions more to upgrade the system so it reaches the outer boroughs and then our upstate communities. $25 billion just in the NYCHA. And we want public housing. Talk about structural racism. That was part of the structural racism. They created people of color, low income, ghettoized them, separated, segregated them, and increased the segregation. We want to use public housing to desegregate, scatter site, quality, middle class, and low income, like they do in Europe. Some of those countries are 30% of the housing is public. They have mixed income, and they don't, and that creates a market where the rents come down all over the whole market. So landlords, it creates a yardstick that the landlords have to compete with. So we want to revitalize the whole public sector, the infrastructure and the public services. And I will argue with the Republicans that that will do better to improve the business climate than their constant tax cuts for the rich and deregulating. We create a level playing field. What we do is lower the cost of living and doing business in New York. Lower the overhead, broadband, energy, and the roads and the transportation infrastructure, and those are the public avenues of private commerce.
So, okay, we'll stop there. Don't want to take too long with that. So any thoughts?
I think he sounds like a great candidate for a better New York, I would think. I love towards the end where he was chiming in on spending less on the energy and the infrastructure we do now. But it fathoms me that we spend interest, spend money on interest. Like the city of Albany spends money on interest.
Yeah.
Why? We're self-sustaining. Why at this point in the history of Albany?
But we're actually not. We are sustained on credit from banks. And so it's part of our platform, Green Party. We're the only people that really push this in any sense. I don't think Bernie-crats mention it as much as we do, if they all. The need for state banks, for public banks that loan money to particularly municipalities, but also everything else. But particularly the state bank is for public goods, to actually fund it, not for profit. And that would go a long way. North Dakota is the only example that has a state bank, and they are insulated from the boom and bust capital cycle because when things are down, the state bank steps up to fund projects.
But then when they're up, they miss out on the opportunity.
Yeah, they have fewer billionaires, I guess, but that's
okay.
It.
Oh, that makes sense. I kind
of
like
the terrible crime of not having a millionaire class.
I would think less billionaires would then include more regular worker, you know, more middle class.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
That's like exactly what it means.
One billionaire probably equals 1 million people in the middle class.
Socialism is not equal poverty, it's equality of, you know, doing all right. And I'll skip ahead now to, I think, Q&A. It's not well.
You say you don't have to win the office to still make a difference. How do you hope to still make that difference if you don't?
Because a vote for us is a vote somebody else didn't get that won. And being politicians, they want to know how they can get those votes. And I think that's what motivated Cuomo to adopt a lot of things he was either opposed to or was afraid to take a position on. He was opposed to the millionaire's tax. He dismissed $15 an hour. Paid family leave, you know, that's something that they were talking about, but he wasn't really pushing it hard until after 2014. And the ban on fracking, I'll tell you, I've been involved in movements. I helped organize the occupation of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant in 1977. We got 1,414 people arrested. It kicked off a whole big anti-nuclear movement. And we thought we had a big struggle then. And when I looked at who we were against on the fracking issue, it was Wall Street. It was all the big oil and gas companies. It was investors from everywhere, from Saudi Arabia to China. I thought, man, we got to fight them, but this is really going to be hard. And
the whole global system.
And that's kind of, you know, victory really gives me hope about the kind of things we can do. And so, you know, I think I don't want to take, you know, all the credit for getting the fracking ban, but I think the fact that we got 5% in 2014 meant Cuomo, even though all the power structure was for it, he said, I got to come out against it because the people are against it. So, you know, my message to voters is vote for what you want. You may not get the candidate to talk about you want, but what you want will have to be taken into account. So use your vote to say what you want, not do what I call political ventriloquism, where you vote for the lesser evil and then try to lobby them and get them to say what you want and say, you're not in a powerful position when you do that.
I know, and that's something I've had to learn the hard way.
Cynthia Nixon put out a release when she entered the race. You know, what are some of the differences between the two of you? She's drawing a lot of attention from progressives right now.
Well, I think the basic difference is strategy. She's a Democrat. She thinks you can move Democrats to a position that will really take care of the people's needs. We've had Democratic, all Democratic government in New York and in Washington in 2010. You can find every Democratic president's had both houses of Congress for at least 1 2-year period. And they can't get down the reforms passed that they really believe because part of their party really doesn't want them. And their funders, their big funders don't want them. So it's not reliable for progressives. But I think that's one big difference. I don't know how she's going to come out on all positions. Another difference is I will answer questions at every news conference. Apparently she hasn't done that yet. I saw one of the reporters complaining about that the other day. She's talking about full funding for public schools. I'm glad she is. Haven't heard her talk about desegregation and how we do that. I mean, I didn't get to it here, but I think we got to provide the kind of incentives Cuomo wants to provide for town and city and village consolidation with counties to have consolidation of school districts that cross the boundaries, because those school district lines have become like Jim Crow lines today in New York. And if you're going to desegregate, you really got to have a different pool on which you draw students. So we'll see if she picks up on that issue. And as far as Syracuse, yeah, I said she wants to have an open forum and a discussion of the issues in Syracuse. I'd be happy to do that, help organize it or host it.
So I'll play one more bit at the end. For those not in the know, because state politics is like, it's not covered very heavily. It's usually a side of a side issue when it comes to what people are paying attention to. Oh, there we go. So Cynthia Nixon is better known. I only knew what the name meant when told. She plays Miranda in Sex and the City.
Oh, yes. I saw her. I saw her view on legalization of marijuana earlier. It was like a Facebook post. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But she
actually saying she's for it, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
A lot of them senators are. Which I mean, Hoylman bill. I think no, not Hoylman.
It just means they pay attention to the news.
Legalization. I'm for decriminalization. I think legalization just creates. It keeps the black market in effect. It just means that if you have enough money for all the licensing and the access to capital to like start the ganja business, you know, in Colorado. It's all rich white guys.
Oh yeah.
And of course it is, because they're the people of capital, opportunity, the resume to get the license. The experience of being a small business owner. And but meanwhile, the
dealers been dishing hot dogs out of my cart for the last 12 years.
The dealers who have been small business owners, but just in a black market sense, they're still in the same place, and thus opportunities are still nil to them. It's just that white people can now afford to get their pot, can get their pot now. But if you try to get other means, so decriminalization of drugs is the position I take. But anyway, but Nixon is like, it's cool that she's running. I think it's a similar kind of thing is happening with Teach Out, tearing the Working Families Party apart. They in 2014, that's when they really became irrelevant, because Cuomo was like, I'm going to get your endorsement one way or the other. And even when he did get it, you know, they got less votes than we did. We got more votes than them, because enough actual thinking people realized that if they want an opposition party, it should at least have its if it's stuffed together as far as what positions it has. The Greens were at least consistent, you know. Internally, there's all kinds of harsh debates, like about what shade of green to use. But at least when it comes to what our platform is, there isn't that much disagreement. And there isn't, and as far in platform as well as strategy. You know, there are these internal debates, but they've kind of been settled now, like the ones about safe states and. Do we work with other independent parties? You know, if they could be an independent, maybe they don't want to change registration. Maybe we will still endorse them. I mean, we want to, because if they're independent, actually independent and have similar platform, and they want to put in the work for their own ballot line, fine. But we'll endorse them, so our people will help them, or at least commit that our activists will help them, because there's more of us every passing year.
Oh, come all ye citizens and hear my tale of woe, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. How I ruined the country with my choice 5 years ago, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Twin Towers fell and 3,000 died, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The terrorists came and there was no place to hide, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Democrats voted to bomb Afghanistan, to cut back freedoms once enjoyed across the land. The party of Jefferson afraid to take a stand, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. W set his sights on Saddam in Iraq, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Democrats gave the okay to attack, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The president said he'd wage eternal war, and the Democrats nodded from the Senate floor. And all the while the money dried up for the poor, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. Now color-coded warnings invade our every thought, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. Duct tape and plastic are all that we've got, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The fires will rage throughout the Middle East, the terrorist threat will continue to increase, and war will go on, there never will be peace, all because I voted for Ralph Nader.
All right, I wanted to really play that. So I can't line up the clip right, you know, if I was a true professional and if say we were supported via our Patreon page with a good amount, I would devote the time and energy into like cutting up the clips just like other podcasts or Jimmy Dore does. Because at the end I ask a question about like there's all these people not voting at all and were participating in these governor races. What are we doing to change that? And he talks about when I campaign, I am also organizing locals. You're getting people involved, kind of having these events, which then become launching points. For example, Matt Funicello run for Congress twice in the mountain, the Adirondacks area. And because of that, meeting all these people, and especially in his own area, a new Warren County Green Party chapter, which is strong, and they've been running their own candidates. They haven't won in Glens Falls yet, but I mean, they had some good showings, like 30%. And now we have the candidate in South Glens Falls, who is now on the board of trustees, Christine Elms. And she was able to do that with their help because they were an active group that had their own fundraisers off season, and then had candidates like myself speak there. So let's go through some announcements. We'll record. My goal is to actually record promos for these so that they're part of the bumpers between other breaks. And April 23rd is a march, so there's going to be a big kind of environmental lobby day, and there's a rally out in Capitol Park, West Capitol Park. But part of that is a march that starts in Sheridan Hollow, my neighborhood, down the hill, and then it's going to go up the stairs up to the Capitol Park. Co-sponsored by SHARE, which is called Sheridan Hollow Alliance for Renewable Energy. This is a group organized by local office holders, actually, like our county legislator, Martin Simpson, to oppose a frack gas energy plant that Como and the state has proposed to build. There's already kind of the heating system. Basically, the plaza and all the state buildings have this combined heating system. So instead of them each having their own boilers and all that garbage, they put it all into the poor area down the hill where pollution is then made. But at the moment, it's not electricity generating, but that's the point, to change it into a gas fire plant. And that's fossil fuel infrastructure. So it's on principle opposing that wherever it may be.
So we're just building up old technology and investing in...
They would say it's present and cutting edge technology, but of course it should be on its way out.
Yeah.
It should be. But that's what we're pushing Como. So it's called Como Walk the Talk on Climate. He talks a big game, but it's like his game is 100% renewable energy in 30 years. It should be 15. Or actually, no, it's not 100%. His goal is 50% by 2050, which is just, you know, that's... Not a plan.
Well, we could definitely...
That's what we'll be.
Damn, we could
nothing.
Definitely do that. At least his goals are
he's
sustainable.
He's being very realistic.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is, you set your actual goal,
you shoot for the stars, you land
on the
moon.
And then you get halfway.
Yeah, that's...
With 50%, then we're only going to get to 20% by then. You know, that's kind of the way we're going.
Yeah, that's...
Further away, though, fast approaching, even though it doesn't feel like spring, is May Day, which is the International Labor Holiday, the actual Labor Day. And since the mid-90s, the Solidarity Committee, which is kind of a group of labor activists, put out labor notes, a little kind of roundup of labor-based news in the area and beyond, union news. We've been doing May Day marches. 1 year we did a big party, block party in Troy. But lately it's been marches based around immigrant issues. So Tuesday, May 1st, take the day off, arrange for the day to be a day off. Also called an informal strike, just don't work. Gonna meet on Central Ave near the church and mosque at North Lake. And we'll march down to Townsend Park, have some speeches and speakers on immigrant rights and their struggles, fighting ICE. Locally, especially with Rensselaer Sheriff. And too many sponsors to name, but mostly political organizations as well as religious ones. And then a lunch at the Nurses Union building, So that'll be nice. But now they've had a victory with the Albany Med. And then an after party with details not yet determined. Too many ums. But it starts at 11-ish, and goes to 3.
And this isn't actually on Earth Day. Earth Day is the 22nd. This is on the Tuesday before. So that's the...
So there's April 23rd. What day of the week is that?
Oh, so that's a Monday.
That's Monday. And then Tuesday, May 1st, May Day, March.
Okay.
So those are two big events coming up. So, okay, we got some minutes left. We're going to start and before the hour so that there's actually time between shows. Now that we're live functioning studio and the schedule's filling up, I'm excited. It's been lonely here, you know. So just a little meme that's been shared. So it's been it's getting some play on Facebook, kind of a half moral panic. Sort of moral panic. I'm less panicked about it. But it's mostly about how many young people under 35 or something aren't educated about the Holocaust. So paired with all the Holocaust survivors are, you know, on their way out. They're all very old. Their stories have been saved, by the way. There were whole projects to make sure that their stories were documented. And there's a whole museum to the Holocaust in D.C. It's a very nice building. I've been there. It's actually very nice. Very nice example of postmodernism done right. And so this is a meme from Catholic Vote. So I'm guessing they're like they're right wing because this is the framing of it. So it's millennials. 66% don't know what Auschwitz was. 22% haven't heard of the Holocaust or aren't sure what it was. And here's their twist. But 44% of them want socialism.
Dun, dun, dun.
Now, these are kind of related as far as, many Americans are miseducated about all kinds of things. Holocaust and socialism included, along with how the economy actually works, how to balance their, how to balance a checkbook, as it were, how to cook, all kinds of things our education system doesn't actually cover, practical or otherwise, even theoretical things, it doesn't cover. It's all geared towards training people to be good, productive workers in the information/creative economy, as if such an economy can handle so much of the workforce. The rest then fall into bureaucracy and us kind of regulating each other, which is basically call-out culture, but call-out culture is an expression of it, that in a society where either everything is allowed or nothing is allowed, it comes out in ugly ways. And of course, it's ugly at the DMV. It's ugly when it's on Tumblr. And it's ugly elsewhere. And we want to reject that whenever possible. And so it's kind of up to us sometimes in the show is my part in re-educating or not re-educating, but, you know, just being a force of positive education. So we'll have more episodes about what is socialism. You know, people are sketchy about it just as they might be sketchy about the Holocaust. Now, here in our school district, Holocaust is covered, right? I don't know about your experience.
I learned about the Holocaust not only through
elementary school, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, from early on to reading the Anne Frank diary to
right. It was required. Now I'm guessing it's not required reading in the South, in Republican dominated school districts, where they'll say slavery was a good thing.
Well, I would think
something like that.
To Kill a Mockingbird would be a lot better for them to read. But, mm-hmm. I mean, even then, who knows what the required literature is for...
Well, they should read Anne Frank Diaries and To Kill a Mockingbird, as we did.
Yeah.
Or as
yeah.
us in the Albany School.
But what happens when the books are unbound and the pages are mm-hmm.
falling apart?
Yeah.
There may not even be a library at all. The schools are defunded.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah,
maybe,
these things are intertwined.
Maybe half of Anne Diaries missing, so they think it's cut off when she... Mm-hmm. finds
you know, halfway through, and she doesn't really know. You know, they
people
don't know
will
the
learn
ending.
About the Holocaust via the Disney movie Anne Frank, where she has
a romantic love, a romantic affair with a Nazi soldier, and
well, not Nazi soldier, but just like another Jewish boy. She okay. has some objects that are alive,
and maybe she writes a blog instead of a diary.
And there's a campy a Nazi woman. Ooh. Who's the villain, and so on. This was a joke made by Lindsay Ellis, by the way.
Okay, no, I like
Disney-fied it. Disneyfied Anne Frank.
I thought this was coming.
And what
off.
Would it look like? And it just makes perfect sense. That's what it would look like.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like
Cruella de Vil.
I always use Cruella de Vil as like, what a great capitalist she is. In that, like, she's just a job creator.
That's
she,
it.
She wants. She's a job creator. She's an owner, entrepreneur, fashion, creative economy, and making puppy coats is you know, so my usual.
She just made a new commodity.
My joke. Yeah. Make a commodity out of Dalmatian puppy skins.
It's not like first she was trying to buy the puppies.
And it's it's an example I use as an extremist of like when people make arguments about this is a weird thing to finish on. but like we need to make jobs no matter what. We need to invite corporations in to create jobs, you know, because they have the access, the capital, and the market control. It's like, well, what if it's Cruella de Vil opening a puppy killing factory? Would you support that? You support a casino, you know, you support sewage waste disposal, you know, all these things that pollute and kill us, you know, and poison our children. And you know you're all and corrupt our values. Where you draw the line? And I don't feel like where is their line? It's not casinos. It's not pollution causing industry. You know there's usually a word about regulating it, but it's not going to happen. You should always assume that's not going to happen. Because look, if you're begging someone to come in, they're holding all the cards.
Yeah.
Just as when Howie says, like, okay, you're going to run as a Democrat, so you have a seat at the table, all right? But you're there as a guest. You're there with zero power, and you're going to accept whatever they throw at you, which will be crumbs. And that's something I've seen time and time again when it comes to reform, like with the campaign finance. We, you know, the big rally, so much support, bills on the table, and even Cuomo would say, I'm for this, we're going to push, you know, we need to clean up our, you know, elections and da da da. But of course, it's the opposite happened. After years of campaigning and organizing the safe way, all right. So we're you know let's be a little unsafe and take some risks. So with that, want to say thank you for listening. This is live broadcast. Hopefully, we'll be online streaming and so on. But I'm editing to prepare so we can put it all up. It'll be accessed and it'll be great. And we'll join the pantheon of great left-wing podcasts, I hope. Then, so well, you can get a start on it by liking the Facebook page, Three Left Show. There's also on Patreon as well. I think I'm allowed to mention it here. But I'm not going to say anything else, just that we have such a page. So with that, thank you for listening. Any parting words?
Just make sure you put your vote into a reliable candidate next year. And voting for a third-party candidate isn't necessarily throwing your vote away, because your vote always matters. And
because you matter.
Because you matter. Thank you, Albany. It's Jeremy Brock. And stay
dangerous.
Stay dangerous with Dan Platt.
Bye.